For me, personally, I try to kind of boil this down to, what do I love about this? And it's not it doesn't necessarily have to be shipwrecks or expeditions or things like that. It's more about living a life which feels dynamic and fulfilled, and where I get to meet interesting people and I get to produce creatively and feel like I can dream about things.
That was maritime historian, shipwreck expert, and author Taylor Zients. And this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Hey, folks. If you are a returning listener, welcome back. And if you're a new listener, welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. It's a show about risk and uncertainty across all walks of life. And we feature long-form conversations with some very interesting people. And I think they're loads of fun. They yield a lot of insights, and they're a pleasure to do. You know, I was trying to get this intro right for, I don't know, about 30 or 40 minutes. And for some reason, I was stuck. And I think I did about a dozen takes of the same thing. And I've noticed that I've been, I think, giving the same intro for the last few episodes. And for whatever reason, today, it just wasn't taking. So I decided to discard the notes that I had, except for the ones that introduce my guests, which we'll get into in a moment, and just kind of freewheel the intro, because, oh my goodness, I don't know why, but I just couldn't get the intro down. I was just not in any state of flow. And so what we're going to be doing is just freewheeling this one. One of the great things about doing this show is that I get to go deep with a particular guest, and I want you to feel like you are part of the conversation, which is why they're long form. And I think sometimes when we have conversations, like, first of all, I don't think that we have proper conversations as much with people anymore. I think it's a long lost art, or it's not that long lost, but it's certainly an art that is going away, because we're all on Facebook or Twitter or whatever the case may be. We're not really connecting with people as much as we can and as we should. And I think that that podcasts like this one are a great antidote. I've used the word antidote to this, but there's probably a better word out there. At any rate, what I like to do is go unscripted and unedited with my guests. And I think that when that happens, great insights come out of those discussions. At least that's what I get out of them. And I love to listen to podcasts that are long form for the very same reason. And this has just been a pleasure. I've had some great people on the show, and I've learned a ton of stuff that I wouldn't have learned before. And I think there's something that comes out of that in terms of a connection, not only with the guest, but also with the listener. There are a lot of great podcasts out there. And as a result, you know, you have lots of choice, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. I'm very grateful to my very dedicated and also growing listenership. We just finished the month of September with the highest number of listens and or downloads to date in terms of monthly downloads. I try not to pay too much attention to that sort of stuff, because I think it's more about the process than the outcome. And I've talked about that. I've had several guests talk about that. But nonetheless, I think it's a sign that we're doing something right. I really, as I said, I really like this concept of going deep with a particular guest and just getting into a particular topic. And sometimes doing a bit of a free association. I love it when guests go off on tangents. you know, we don't get to do that much of that sort of thing nowadays, nor do we get to listen to that much of content that is like that. Everything's sort of canned and packaged, and sometimes it's good to get away from that. Anyway, speaking of going deep, I want to get into today's episode, and this is an area that we haven't really explored very much, or haven't explored at all, and there's probably no one or very few people out there in the world like my guest today. His name is Taylor Zients, and he is a maritime historian, a shipwreck expert, and an author. And as I said, there aren't too many people like him out there. And I don't know about you, but when I was 19 years old, I did not have the type of experience that he did. And let me just describe this to you. When he was 19, he joined, or he effectively participated in a Russian expedition to what is the deepest archaeological site on the planet. And that is 3 miles underwater into the Bermuda Triangle to explore a trading ship that went down sometime in the 1800s, but wasn't really discovered until the 1960s or 70s. And you know, we talk about that, but I think if you have an experience like that at the age of 19, you're not going to become an accountant, as I told Taylor on the episode. And that really shaped his life and career path very much. So he became this shipwreck expert, and he studied loads of shipwrecks and has some very interesting insights into some of the commonalities and what went wrong. And we would certainly talk about that, a great part of that conversation. We talk about these kinds of expeditions and risk-taking in these kinds of expeditions. And there are a number of parallels with a number of my previous guests, in that things like expeditions in which you go several meters under the ocean and you do certain things that are quite unconventional, they might seem very risky, but we talk a lot about the preparation involved in those kinds of things. And you know, when you think about that, these kinds of expeditions aren't necessarily that risky. But anyway, I don't want to preempt the conversation. We talk about Taylor's blog. He's got a wonderful blog called The Expedition Writer, in which he's got some great stories about all types of interesting expeditions, urge you to check it out. You can look in the show notes and have a look at that. We get into one story in particular, which is a story that is the stuff of urban legend. And he's also an author. He wrote a novel, a fiction novel called The Wrecking Crew, in which he pulled together a number of the strands to his life. And he's working on a sequel to that novel, and we do talk about that. It's a very fun conversation. I think you're going to be, you'll enjoy it. It's, as I said, not a conversation that we've had, or type of conversation that we've had before on this show. But Taylor is not the kind of guy that you run into very often. So that's me waffling on with my unscripted intro. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Taylor Zients. Enjoy. Taylor, thank you very much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Oh, same here. So happy to be here.
Excellent. Taylor, I'm going to start with this question, which I tend to ask of many of my guests, and I'm always kind of after the answer that the answer that people struggle to come up with. But that is, you know, what do you do? What is what's your background, your profession, if you like?
Yes. So I am a maritime historian and shipwreck expert. Mm-hmm. I work for a small company that looks for historic shipwrecks. I've been doing this with different groups for numbers of years at this point. Also an author. And I've written a number of different novels at this point, mostly in the genre. The first one was released this year, and the next one is coming out soon here.
Fabulous. Yeah, that's great. I love people that have different, you know, different hats and different, you know, different things that they do and they've done. And you certainly fit that bill. I wanted to get into some of your we'll get into some of the adventures that you've done, but I wanted to get a little bit into your background. Shipwreck explorer isn't necessarily something that a lot of people have on their resumes, on their CVs, and I'm just curious as to what led you to this as the thing that you do.
Well, like a lot of people, I really kind of fell into it. It was not something that I really sought after. Mm-hmm. Besides having a real keen interest in this kind of thing, I've always been somebody that I've always loved reading, especially history, anything I can get my hands on pretty much, especially as I was growing up. And my dad ended up being involved in a project in the mid-90s centering around the a Japanese World War II era submarine called the I-52. Mm-hmm. Now, she wasn't really like an attack submarine like most of them were in the Second World War. She was actually more of a transport submarine. Mm-hmm. So she was sunk by the Americans in the Atlantic Ocean, which is, from the Japanese perspective, the wrong ocean.
Yeah, a little far away from home, yeah.
Very far away from home, because she was on the gold for tech trade with Germany late in the war. All overland routes had long since been cut off, and the only way that Germany could get things like gold, opium, certain metals, rubber, in exchange for high-tech engines and weapons and technicians was through these very secret submarine exchanges. But at this point in the war, the Americans, the Allies had broken both sets of codes, both the German and the Japanese codes, and were in the process of hunting down these submarines and sinking them one at a time. Mm. And this was one of those submarines. The I-52 was sunk by a acoustic-seeking torpedo from a plane that was launched from a small aircraft carrier in the Atlantic and sank in about 3.5 miles of water. Mm-hmm. So really, really deep. There was a group that found her again using kind of Cold War era Russian deep sea search technology. Mm-hmm. And then my dad ended up being part of the process to come and revisit the site using a couple of Russian, again, Cold War era submersibles.
Wow.
If you've ever seen the movie Titanic,
yeah,
the big white ship in the very beginning, the two little submersibles,
okay.
Even the crew, that's all real technology. Those are all real people, too.
Mm-hmm. Wow, just fascinating that you're...
So,
go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sorry if I'm telling the long version of this story.
No, and you know what? We like long versions of stories around here, so please, go for it.
Oh, absolutely. So after that, he ended up being involved in some additional projects, and then he started to be able to bring his sons, myself and my younger brother. And for us, this was just the most incredible thing that we could imagine. Mm-hmm. The types of people that were aboard these expeditions were absolutely just, some of the smartest people of their generations. It was Russian scientists. There were a number of Americans that were on board, too. Including Don Walsh, who set the record for deepest dive ever when he took the Trieste to the bottom of Mariana's Trench back in the 60s. So given that these are expeditions, longer voyages, there's time to just sit down and talk with almost everybody.
Wow.
And as a young person, as a teenager at that time, you can't sit down and talk with people that have done things like this in their lives and not have that affect who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. I ended up being a part of a couple of additional expeditions, mostly just as a passenger, including a couple of trips out to the Titanic. back when they were running essentially tourist expeditions to the Titanic. And then another expedition to a kind of a mysterious target that was lost deep within the Bermuda Triangle. And for that one, I was age 19, and I actually had an opportunity to take a ride on one of the submersibles and went 3 miles down deep to visit this shipwreck site.
Let's just wonder if we could talk about that. You wrote a lovely post on your blog about it, and it sounded like a fabulous adventure. I'm wondering if we could spend a little bit of time talking about that particular expedition and what you saw, and there's some lovely little stories in the article about it. But this was an old wasn't a galleon, but it was like a trading ship. Is that right?
That was our guess. Best guess is that it was a coastal trading ship, an inner islands trading ship from about 1812 or so.
How did they know that it was there?
This one had a really, really interesting backstory to it. And it goes all the way back to the some of the early NASA space launches, of all things. So this was pretty far off the coast of Florida, off the east coast of Florida. NASA used to, in the very early days, before they were sending people that would orbit the entire Earth, they would send these low orbit launches up, where they would basically send these tiny capsules up that would kind of kiss the edge of space and then drop back down to the ocean about 200 miles to sea. So one of those launches was the Gus Grissom Liberty Bell 7 launch. It was part of the Mercury Redstone project. I think that this was early 60s, I want to say. And something went wrong when he splashed down. He was supposed to just sit there bobbing the ocean until he was picked up by a helicopter. But what happened was the hatch blew on his capsule and started flooding. He was barely able to get out. He actually almost sank too, because one of his valves was open in his spacesuit, and his spacesuit started flooding. So he was supposed to just float there, and instead he started sinking. So he was rescued. The space capsule was not. And it left this controversy of, did Gus Grissom panic and hit the hatch button?
Okay.
Or was it poorly engineered? So this was a big fight between the engineers and the astronauts, and management eventually came down on Gus Grissom's side. And then in the late 90s, Discovery Channel decided that they were going to go and they were going to solve this mystery. So they were able to successfully use a deep sea sonar to search the bottom of the ocean. They came up with they found the capsule, they retrieved it. It's now in a museum in Kansas. But the person that conducted that search, Kurt Newport, part of his deal with Discovery Channel was that he was able to keep all of that deep sea sonar data. And as part of that deep sea sonar data, he found a target within it. He took that target to experts and he asked them what they thought of it. They took a look at it and they said, we can tell you two things. One is it's wooden, and the second is it's old. And that's how this Russian expedition to the Bermuda Triangle was came to be. It's, how could you hear something like that and not go check it out?
Just by way of background, and I don't know how all of this works, but when something like that happens, there's a target, and then how do expeditions get kind of put together? Is it who funds it? How do the teams come together? How do they decide what equipment to use? All of that stuff. How does that work? Is it a public or a private venture? What happens?
Yeah, well, there is kind of, like public sector counterparts. In the United States, that's NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. The UK, of course, has their own organization. I don't recall what it is off the top of my head. I've always been involved in private organizations that have done this kind of thing. So Depending on what the objective is, that makes a really big difference in how it's funded. If it's a film expedition, maybe there's a backing network or a studio or something like that. If it's private, sometimes it gets paid for by people that want to come along to just see what there is to see on these kinds of things. That's how trips out to the Titanic, for instance, were oftentimes funded. Okay. Mm-hmm. So people that wanted to go see it for themselves. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it's, you know, there's really a lot of different ways to do this. Sometimes it's one big sponsor. Sometimes it's a public company and people have bought stock. It really depends. As far as equipment goes, there's a really kind of limited a number of people and equipment that, that do this kind of thing. Okay. And it tends to be shared between a lot of different industries. It's not just film and television and exploration, but it's also oil and gas and cable laying and things like that. Anything that has to do with the deep ocean, there tends to be a lot of overlap with the type of people and equipment that that do it.
Okay. No, very fascinating stuff. Okay, well, let's continue with the story of this interesting target.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So there is a there's a mysterious target, 3 miles deep, Bermuda Triangle. Experts have said it's wooden and it's old. So an expedition is formed to go after it. Mm-hmm. At this time, I was 19 years old, and I had an opportunity to join the expedition. It's my dad was one of the people that helped organize it, and that was the connection there. And you know, my dad went on one of the first submersible trips down to see this mysterious target. As part of his compensation, he had a second submersible trip organized that he gave up his seat for, so that I, at 19 years old, could take it and have an opportunity to see it. It was pretty incredible. I mean, our family's always been the type that values experience. And over really a lot of other things.
Right.
You know, it was one of his big dreams in order to kind of, you know, show the world to my brother and I and show us how amazing it could be. And it was an effective thing. I mean, you can't climb into a little submersible and go to the bottom of the ocean and not come up changed. It's impossible.
That's fabulous. So you did climb into this. So when we say submersible, What does that look like? What is this vehicle?
Yes. So they're a lot smaller than the type of submarines that you might see like a Navy using or something like that, because they're not designed to be in the water all the time. They're basically designed to be dropped in and then retrieved once the mission is over. So this one, I think it was about 20 feet long or so. But that was the exterior. The interior was only about 6 feet in diameter, and it was a steel sphere with a couple of little portals. The largest one, I think, was maybe 6-8 inches. The other portals are more like 4 inches. Really, really small, because it's designed to go 3 miles deep, where the amount of pressure down there is several tons per square inch. So it's three people. Steel sphere, 6 feet in diameter, for about 15 hours in our case.
Okay, a little cramped.
yeah, absolutely. And if you've ever seen the movie Titanic, the submersibles at the very beginning are the real deal.
Right.
The Russian pilots are the real Russian pilots that have actually been doing that for 30 plus years. They really got a lot right with that movie.
Very cool. Okay, so you had yourself and who were the other gentlemen with you that were in the submersible?
So it was myself. There was an attorney out of Boston who was another person that helped organize this trip. He's now an executive at the Explorers Club.
And by the way, really, I love the little story about the book in your post that this guy wrote. great if you could share that.
Yeah, what was interesting too is that he I'm not sure if anybody really remembers these, but back in the late 90s, there was a really popular book series called Worst Case Scenario. Mm-hmm. It was all about what to do if you had to, for instance, jump from a motorcycle to a moving car, or if or if other kind of terrible things happened to you when you were traveling or your day-to-day life, how to dodge bullets if somebody's shooting at you, that kind of stuff. And he ended up writing the foreword for one of those books about how he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, ended up with two detached retinas and a collapsed lung, and then took the smoking section from from Tanzania back to Germany before he received any medical treatment. So there was some disaster magnet jokes.
Yeah. So you went down. So you're like, this is my companion for the day.
But he's a fantastic guy. Very good person to spend 15 hours in a submersible with.
very cool. Must have been very interesting. So it took you how long to get to the target? How long is that?
So it took us about 3 hours to descend down to the bottom of the ocean. Mm-hmm. But by that time, subsea currents push around the submersibles for so long that you're off station. You no longer know exactly where you are.
Yeah.
So we actually had to start running a search pattern, and we had to spend a number of hours just finding the shipwreck again on the bottom of the ocean.
Okay. Huh. And when you did find it, what did it turn out to be? What are the sort of sensations? What does that sort of look like? Are you looking out of a window of this submersible, or how are you trying to maneuver and look at? How did you know, when you found it, that indeed that's what it was?
Yeah, let me kind of paint a picture here. Mm-hmm. So first, it's almost completely silent because there's so much steel surrounding you inside this little submersible that really not much in the way of sound, really no sound can really get through that. So you can hear some instrumentation and things like that going on the inside, ballast pumps, but other than that, completely silent as we glide over the ocean bottom. Strange enough, it almost kind of looks like a desert down there. Think very long rolling dunes.
Okay.
In many cases, these dunes are shaped by currents and other kind of subsea forces. We could only see as far as our lights would go, because anywhere that the light doesn't touch, there hasn't been light down there ever.
Right.
Light trickles out only a couple hundred feet, and we were at 16,700 feet deep. Mm-hmm. We were really deep. So these endless, rolling sands on the ocean bottom, it just looks like an alien world, like nothing you've ever seen before. Some sparse sea life on the bottom, but then this shipwreck, the minute that we were on top of it, you could just tell instantly that, because something man-made down there is so foreign that you just can't miss it at all. So the shipwreck, I think it was about maybe 60 feet long. A lot of the superstructure was gone. Anything that was kind of protected by this copper cladding along the underside of the hull was still there. But mostly it looks like these ribs sticking up. So it almost looked like, you could compare it to like a whale skeleton or something like that, where it's only like the really thick beams stick up. And then within the shipwreck itself, there's a lot of rum bottles, there was a lot of coconuts, there was dishware, a big pile of silver, and some other smaller artifacts like pistols and a telescope, a sextant, and things like that.
And you ended up, so then you end up collecting these artifacts, right? And how does that work? How do you pull this stuff, out from the bottom and up to the surface?
Yeah, so this is all done under the supervision of a marine archaeologist who guided everybody through the whole project and what he needed to do his job. And these Russian submersible pilots were actually recruited out of the ranks of the Russian Air Force fighter pilots. So these are ex-MiG pilots. So the amount of skill that these guys have are just incredible. So they can basically take these massive submersibles, hover them against a flowing current, and then using a little suction cup that's not much bigger than your finger, they can delicately reach down and pick up one individual coin at a time.
Wow.
That's the level of talent that these guys have, and skill honed over just years and years and years. They are incredible pros.
Jeez.
So little suction cups, bring it up very delicately, put it in a collection basket so that it could survive what could be at times a bit of a rough ride once we hit the surface.
Mm-hmm. Jeez, yeah, very interesting. And so you made it back up to the surface, obviously, and I guess you sifted through all of these artifacts and.
It took a few days. Some of them were in really good shape. Anything that's like a hard metal, like a gold or silver, is in really good shape. Things like telescopes and pistols, they're going to have to be under some form of conservation pretty much forever, definitely. But the marine archaeologist was kind enough to make me part of his crew. I kind of got pulled into helping with that, and it was a fantastic experience. He taught me how he did kind of that little part of his job, and we found some amazing things. We even found a piece of newspaper that was still legible. We pulled it out of a little box, spread it out, and it turns out it was basically classified ads from Kingston, Jamaica in 1820. Yeah.
What were some of the ads? What does a newspaper that old contain?
A lot of like property advertisements and things like that.
Yeah, cool.
For the industries that they had at that time, that was kind of my big exposure to this world.
Wow. And I can see, so if you're 19 years old and you get, have this great opportunity to go on this expedition, after that, it's you're kind of, there's no way you're going to become an accountant, right? Or whatever it is. I can only imagine that, this kind of expedition bug grabbed hold of you.
It really did. The most important piece of this for me was always getting an opportunity to meet interesting people and do interesting things. So there's really so many different ways to scratch that same itch. You don't necessarily need to be heading out into the oceans every year and chasing a project. I found that being an author, for me, it really scratches all those same kind of feelings. I have an opportunity to talk to groups, meet really fascinating people. It's an opportunity to do research. It's a creative endeavor. For me, there's a lot of overlap between these things and what I've written.
I guess you became this professional shipwreck researcher, right? Is that what you ended up doing next, or?
It was another one of those really improbable kind of confluence of events to make that happen as well.
Okay.
So how that worked was I was almost done with college.
What did you study, by the way?
I was studying psychology things.
Okay.
Really nothing that had anything to do with that. I thought that this was kind of something I had an opportunity to do a few times. And, when I was a teenager, I wasn't sure if I was ever going to get another chance to do something like that. But what ended up happening was there was a new company that had just found a big shipwreck off of South Carolina, Civil War era steamship that had a lot of gold on board. Mm-hmm. And they were hiring like crazy, including one of the most entry-level positions on the ship, which was assistant to the archaeologist.
Okay.
So I had a chance to basically complete my degree by correspondence, fly across the country, and join this expedition. So I spent 3 months working with this archaeologist on the Civil War era steamship as they were pulling gold and silver and artifacts off of it, doing aerosol filming and bringing up things that could be used to create museum exhibits and whatnot. Mm-hmm. In fact, at one point we were pulling so much gold and silver off this wreck that I was in a locked room with two other guys counting it for 14 straight hours.
Wow.
it was just incredible.
Wow.
So I spent about three months at sea doing that, and then I got brought into the their main headquarters, their office. Originally, they hired me as an administrator, somebody that could kind of answer phones, make copies, whatever else needed doing. But then I read the entire research library. I organized it, and I wrote a white paper on how I felt that we should be doing our jobs. And after that, pretty soon they were sending me overseas. They sent me to Europe 4 times. I was coordinating researchers on 3 different continents, and as we were doing this big ramp up to look for additional projects.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. We talked a little bit about this in our correspondence, but in your work, you've explored, I guess, I don't know how many historical shipwrecks have you, or shipping accidents have you, or sinkings? I don't know how many you've researched, but I'm assuming it's quite a few. I'm just curious as to some things that you found to be either interesting or some commonalities to some of these accidents. Like what are some of the things that have historically caused some of these shipwrecks that might, that might have a common thread to them?
From a cause standpoint, anything that can happen from on a long enough timeline will happen. Mm. So really frequently you'll see this confluence of highly improbable events. Such as, we have a project that we're working on off of Boston right now, and it was the second largest ship of her era. This was 1860. She was a massive iron ship, state of the art, but so many things had to go just perfectly wrong for this ship to go down. So what happened was she was in a terrible storm, which is kind of like the first element, something that would have been survivable, right?
Yeah.
And as she's tossing in this terrible storm, she has a pipe break. Hmm. And that pipe break starts leaking water into the ship. She starts getting this big influx of water. So again, survivable. She has pumps. Mm-hmm. She's got, plenty of time. She's really large. She has some watertight compartments, I think, in this one too. So again, survivable. But what that does is then shifts the weight of the ship. So now she's now listing to one side. Mm-hmm. So again, you'd say survivable. But then what that listing does is that makes so that the heat dispersion from her coal-fired furnaces is not being properly vented to the exterior of the ship. Now the heat is going through the iron sides of these boilers and ends up catching the ship on fire amidship. Mm-hmm. So you have all of these kind of like, stacking improbabilities, putting the ship in a position where the whole thing is now on fire while simultaneously flooding.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, it's on a long enough timeline, anything that can go wrong will go wrong, even if it's highly improbable.
Yeah.
So whether that's going to be, you know, storm, fire, having a terrible captain, navigation errors, wartime, or just acts of God, it's these things happen.
That's I mean, that's interesting. I mean, we sometimes call those things failure cascades when, you know, one thing goes wrong and then the next thing and the next thing, and it's just a sort of chain of events that that leads to something that, you know, when you look at the end result is pretty seems pretty improbable, but then when you go back and, you know, link up all the different elements, you can kind of see how it you know, how they all fit together.
That's exactly it. And, you know, when you start talking about over hundreds of years, that that those loss levels and those improbable events start becoming increasingly quantifiable also.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Like in terms of quantifiable, is that help with, you know, where to look for things, or how's that made? I mean, have you seen ship going become safer as a result of learning from these things?
Yeah, we tend to not focus too much on that side of things.
Okay.
Just because, you know, we kind of focus on the losses rather than the learning from the losses that you know, marine architects and engineers and things like that focus on.
Okay.
But really the whole kind of thrust of what I do is in some way, shape, or form trying to quantify uncertainty. We deal a lot with things like witness accounts of these accidents, and you have to really understand where this person is coming from. You know, what's their motivation? What was their subjective experience as they're going through this terrible event?
Yeah.
And what can we learn from it? People, you know, people don't experience things in objective ways, doubly so when they're under stress. So we deal with a lot of things like time compression, time dilation, you know, people basically even rewriting their own memories to recast themselves in a better light.
Okay.
In retrospect, you know, just the fact that people were at the time dealing with very, very little information, such as in that wreck that I was just telling you about. The fire basically divided the ship into two sections, the forward ship and the rear of the ship, and those people couldn't even talk to each other. They had no idea what was happening on the other side of their own ship. So a lot of uncertainty, and trying to kind of turn that into probability, which turns that into actionable projects.
Okay. So when you say actionable projects, it means I mean, how are you going back? Like I guess as like a bit of a detective going back and figuring out how a shipwreck occurred.
That's exactly right. So I'll do things like put together timelines. I'll put together heat maps of where I think that the ship, the probabilities of where the ship likely went down.
Okay.
It is an effort to quantify and contextualize really every piece of information that we can possibly find relating to a sinking event.
Right. I can imagine, actually, when you talked about, you know, studying psychology, when you're trying to go back and look at eyewitness accounts and lawyers and people in the judicial, you know, profession talk about how unreliable eyewitness accounts actually are. I mean, everyone, you know, memories are not they may seem strong, but actually when you go back, you find a lot of people's memories are not as good as they say. I'm just curious as to how, you know, how you dealt with that aspect of you know, eyewitness accounts of some of these things.
That's absolutely right. There's a lot of psychology that goes into it. First and foremost, try to establish what the person's motivation is. You know, do they want to cast themselves in a heroic light, in a sympathetic light? You know, do they want to reduce their own culpability for the accident? Oftentimes, we'll see captains you know, it's, even in the modern era, with some of these recent cruise ship accidents, we get to see these captains and how they react to these events, trying to explain what they did and why they did it. So you can draw a pretty direct line through history to some of the projects that I've worked on. Also, people fixate too, right? You know, if you give somebody a job like bailing out the ship, even if it's an impossible task, oftentimes you will see people who are so fixated on that that they won't give up even when the ship is completely lost. Even if they have no chance in the world, people have a tendency to see details and not the whole, too. And to be very focused on just the one thing that maybe they think that they can control, as opposed to the big picture and what's happening. So for that, it's, I actually have, you know, I have the world's weirdest resume, but I actually have a background in wilderness search and rescue as well. So that was, that has been incredibly helpful in understanding kind of the mindset of people that are under extreme stress.
What are some of the things that, that you know, people tend to do when they're under extreme stress that, that is, you know, sort of common? Or is there, you know, is there commonality?
I think that it brings out the spectrum of personalities, because, you know, when you have these extreme events, it really brings out the most extreme in somebody's personality. For some people, this is extreme heroism, where they find themselves as the sort of person that would jump into the water, into freezing water, to rescue somebody at risk of their own life, even if they didn't maybe think that they were the type of person that would do that. It also brings out a lot of kind of other extremes. You know, you've got a certain degree of self-medication in a lot of these cases, where people break into the wine racks if they think they're going to die because they don't want to die sober. People that are willing to, you know, push aside women and children in order to save themselves. It really brings out this incredible spectrum of human personality.
I was just thinking about that that Italian ship captain a couple of years ago, I think it was, at abandoned ship during during that cruise ship. I forget the name of the vessel now, but he, you know, it sounded like he abandoned ship when, what, you know, just at the wrong, precisely the wrong moment.
Yeah, the Costa Concordia.
That's right. That's right. The Costa Concordia. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe in that incident, he maybe even cut in line as people were being rescued by helicopter. The funny thing about that from a rescue standpoint, though, is the rescuers need to keep things moving. So if they have somebody that's being disruptive like that, oftentimes it's better for everybody if they just grab that person and go, as opposed to trying to reason with them or kind of handle the situation another way.
Sure. And I guess that's where you get other stories of, you always hear this guy drowned trying to save these two people in a, you know, in a current or something like that. That you wonder, well, what compelled that person to dive in and think that they could save these two people or whatever. It is interesting.
Yeah, I've always found that deeply, deeply fascinating. You know, how people react to things under stress. I think that for some people, it's they just couldn't live with themselves if they didn't at least try.
Do you think there's any way of testing for that? Like, you know, trying to simulate those conditions to just kind of see what the response might be, or is it just difficult to say?
I think to a certain extent you can train for that. I think that, you know, whether it's the military or search and rescue, first responders, emergency services, it's a lot goes into the psychology of how you get somebody to, in many ways, act against their own personal self-interest in order to accomplish a goal. As far as testing for that, that's a really good question. I think that to a certain extent, All of our big decisions are a result of many very tiny decisions. So if you are somebody that has a history of being, you know, compassionate and somebody that speaks up rather than being a bystander, mm-hmm. Somebody that believes that they can, that they have an effect on the world around them, as opposed to being just kind of floating along with the current of life, I think that you're going to get somebody that's very highly likely to act in a situation like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the flip side is none of us know until we're there.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. We like to think we'd be the cool, calm, collected one that makes all the right decisions, but it's difficult to know. I work with organizations a lot on things like crisis management and business continuity, and whenever the real deal happens, it's you never know who steps up to the plate, and and then people that have got various job titles next to their names, they might be a bit of a shrinking violet as well. So it's hard to say. But it is, I agree. It's a fascinating area of psychology. You know, what would you do if it all kind of goes wrong? And I don't know how true to life you think this is, or if you've seen the, I think it's the movie Everest, which was based on the I'm not sure if it was based on John Krakauer's book completely, but when you just look at the ego, you know, the ego that went into some of those decisions about not turning around and things like this. People on mountainsides that strip off all their clothing, and and it gets pretty weird. I wanted to talk about your blog. You started this Expedition Writer blog, which is really fascinating, and I'm just curious. Actually, in your writing career generally, what possessed you to start that, and what was your sort of vision for it? And there's some wonderful stories and series on there.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. So the idea of it basically came from I just really wanted to be kind of, I call it being part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. We're having this, this worldwide conversation on exploration, conservation, science, and adventure, and having a blog about that for me was an opportunity to reach out and be in touch with really incredible people. Mm-hmm. That normally I just wouldn't have access to. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you just can't call up somebody you find interesting and just see if they want to chat with you.
Yeah.
But if you've got a blog, sometimes you can make a compelling case and make a new friend that way.
Absolutely, and a podcast as well, like we're doing today. But yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I wanted to get into maybe a couple of the stories and the posts that you have there. I mean, one is this the story of D.B. Cooper, who is this the stuff of urban legend almost? The guy who hijacked the plane and jumped out with a parachute, or maybe not. I'd love to talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, that's a fun one. I worked on that with a friend of mine and fellow shipwreck researcher, John Griffith. Mm-hmm. He did the bulk of the work for it and wrote it up for my blog. But, we spent a lot of time talking about that. The idea there was, first a little bit of background. Mm-hmm. D.B. Cooper was one of probably the most famous airline hijacker, and kind of what was the golden age of airline hijackers, where he boarded a plane. I believe he claimed he had a bomb. He asked for parachutes and something like $100,000 in cash in order to leave mm-hmm. peacefully. Mm-hmm. And up in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where I live, he's legendary. You know, everybody's kind of curious where the money ended up. Mm-hmm. And the mystery is really compelling. So as it is with a lot of mysteries like this, there just seems to be layer and layer and layer of theories and kind of amateur investigations, which they seem to pile on top of each other and influence each other a great deal. So my friend and I basically, this was just for fun, said, okay, well, what if we started with a completely blank slate and we approach this the way that we'd approach one of our other projects, right? As a lot of the people have done this to date, they may have a very strong background in aviation or criminal investigation, but they don't really have kind of the same approach as we do, which is to take this like an old incident, really try to learn as much as possible from it from a non-biased way, and then kind of tackle it holistically. Because a criminologist is going to, or a detective is going to approach it from a criminology standpoint. An aviator from an aviation standpoint, you know, and so forth, right? So we wanted to try to take as non-biased of an approach as possible. And we pretty much, the results that we came up with was that it's pretty highly likely that he didn't even survive the jump, given the conditions that he jumped under, and also the fact that I think the majority of his parachutes were not even proper parachutes. And then when you do an overlay of the area that he jumped with the watershed of that area, where all of the different rivers and streams drain out into the ocean, and also where some of the money was found, which was on a riverbank a great distance away from where he jumped, I think you come up with the result that he's highly likely to have ended up in the water somehow, or at least in a flood zone where he and his parachute and the money ended up washed out to sea.
That's a fascinating story, and what would possess somebody to hatch that kind of plan as well. and obviously, you know, given your conclusions, you know, not particularly well thought through.
There was some magical thinking involved, right? That the police are going to give me a real parachute, you know, that they're not going to come up with some other plan. That, I mean, the whole thing was really poorly conceived.
Speaking of which, you know, on the flip side of that, just in terms of expeditions and you know, getting expeditions right, doing things the right way. You know, obviously there are a number of risks associated with any of these things, and I'm just wondering about your own take on, you know, how to manage some of the risks, particularly, you know, something like, you know, that expedition that you were on, you know, it was super deep, and you know, whether or not anyone's gone to those depths before, you know, might mean there's a whole range of factors that you'd have to consider, a whole range of risks. I'm just curious about, in terms of expeditions, the approach to risk taking, because some of these things are viewed perhaps as as risky, but I would have thought that, you know, to succeed, you really have to, you know, you really have to know what you're doing and know what you're getting into. You know, what are your thoughts on that? How does risk taking, risk management in expeditions, you know, how does that work?
Well, that's a good question. So I'll kind of approach this from a couple of different ways. For one, with my dive, so that would be like a personal risk, right? Because there's at least conceivably a personal level of danger. What's really interesting between the brains of teenagers and adults is that adults will basically say something like, that sounds dangerous, I'm not going to do it. Whereas teenagers will actually go through the process of trying to calculate odds. Now, they're not necessarily very good at that, but that's, you know, that's why they end up taking a lot of risks that adults would never even conceive of taking. So, you know, I was 19 when I did that. My thought process was, as far as I know, nobody's ever gotten killed doing something like this. I couldn't imagine not doing it. So the personal risk kind of seemed very far away, and definitely worth it. Now that I'm a dad, you know, who knows? Maybe I'd have a different approach to it. Maybe not. From a project standpoint, in my opinion, like, the largest risk that you can work to mitigate is ego.
Right.
Because, you know, people, you have to be able to question aspects of a mission without questioning, without feeling like the person behind it is questioned, right? Mm. So in, with equipment, that could be, you know, can we double check that? Can we look at what you put together, make sure it's right? Mm. With my research reports, which is what I do, I have an approach with that is anybody within the mission can question any aspect of my research report.
Mm-hmm.
I really try to foster not just questions, but also even argument. I want people to argue with me because if we can do that in a dispassionate way, then it's I'm going to do my job better.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've worked with a couple people that, you know, maybe at first they're like, oh, can I ask about this without damaging this guy's ego?
Mm.
I really try to turn that into a positive experience for them so that they'll do it again.
Right, yeah.
Because, you know, it's like, frankly, like, people have caught errors in what I've done. People have brought up really, really good points that were worth investigating. And, you know, not no one person is a repository of all knowledge. So, really, from a systemic, holistic standpoint, the number one thing that you can try to mitigate is ego.
That's fascinating. That's yeah, because if you're attached to a particular outcome or a theory or a way of doing things, then you can really get it badly wrong.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've seen that happen, and it's, you know, it's such a tragic way for something to go wrong too, because out of everything, it's also one of the easiest things to, I mean, on paper, it's the easiest to mitigate. When you're actually, when you're dealing with actual personalities, then maybe it's a different question.
Yeah. Yeah. Now they do, there are a number of fascinating studies on the whole, that whole topic, and also, hierarchy as well. I don't know if you came across the it was one of Malcolm Gladwell's books, but he talked about the different airlines, their air safety records, and the ones that had the poorest records were the ones that kept a very strict hierarchy in the cockpit, so that the co-pilot couldn't question what the pilot was doing and this kind of thing.
That's fascinating.
I used to work, or I worked for a year and a bit in Korea as a English teacher, and it's one of the more hierarchical cultures that you could possibly imagine, sort of very Confucian, and Korean Air was one of those airlines with a very poor safety record, and it's, you know, precisely because of that, and, you know, that the co-pilots knew, oh, we're about to crash or whatever, but they wouldn't question the pilot's judgment, which it just seems farcical but also tragic.
Very much so. I almost came at that kind of same problem from the opposite end, which is in my background in wilderness search and rescue. It was almost a completely flat organization from a hierarchy standpoint. There were, of course, you know, people who were trainees and then people who were fully qualified, but every single person trained with every single station, every single role within the organization.
Right.
So what was fantastic about that is, you know, when you're against a deadline or rather time pressure to find somebody or accomplish something, you can just grab the three nearest people, right, and then put them on the problem. Everybody is allowed to look over each other's shoulder and check each other's work, so to speak, especially when you're dealing with rope systems or other kind of high angle aspects of wilderness rescue. It really made for a highly effective organization. And during the time that I was with it, they hadn't had a serious accident in their entire 50-year history.
That's fascinating. So that was,
I thought that it was a brilliant way of approaching. It took an awful lot of work,
tons of
training to get this down, because it's, it's not a, human beings are attracted to hierarchy, and this was a kind of a counterintuitive way of doing this, but it was very effective.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think that there's some broader lessons there. I've had one of my earlier guests talk about some of the problems with just organizations generally, and hierarchy is one of the biggest problems that organizations run. That fail from a risk standpoint. They become very rigidly hierarchical, and those that are flatter, across many industries tend to do better. Which is, it's just interesting stuff. Ego is a terrible thing as well. And when you get attached to your role, right? People, I'm the boss, and you have to sort of listen to me, and just that whole process of listening to your employees, really listening well and thoroughly, and taking it all in and making the decisions is one of the hardest things to do, and I think one of the things that we're getting less good at over time for a number of reasons. But that's a bit of an aside, but very, very powerful lessons. Interesting that you've shared those things. I did want to talk about your novel writing, your fiction writing, and the novel, The Wrecking Crew, that you pulled together and that you wrote, and where did the idea come from, and what drove you to that?
The idea came from an expedition to the English Channel, actually, where we ended up uncovering a number of World War II era German U-boats. So the interesting thing about that is the historical record of what U-boats sank where is not necessarily accurate. It was kind of cobbled together after the war by comparing U.S. and German archives. And so our effort was to identify what U-boat we'd actually found by doing a lot of research and coming up with kind of a matrix of, what U-boat was equipped with what equipment at what time, and other really very subtle features that were difficult to kind of see before we did the work. But in that time, I became really fascinated with World War II submarine captains, and especially on the German side, where later into the war, it was, it was an incredibly tragic situation for them. They were not very political compared to other branches of the German war machine, but they were also suffering the highest attrition rates. They were losing more men as a percentage than anybody else. So you had these groups of people, young men, sometimes their captain will only be in their early 20s, under just the most brutal conditions you can possibly imagine, having to think their way out of one problem after another. So I kind of wondered to myself, could you take some of the personality aspects that it took to survive in those conditions, and could you transfer that into somebody in the modern era? So that's where the genesis of the character came from. It ended up being a real fun adventure with kind of like a Jason Bourne meets Hunt for the Red October. The great thing for me is I have access to people who work in deep sea industries. So I get to buy them beers, listen to their stories. I get to shoot them drafts and see what they think. Have one guy who I respect just immensely. He has done so much in deep water, everything from working for James Cameron on some of his deep sea projects to recovering military aircraft and about a million other projects. If it's under the sea, he's done it at some point. So he read the book and he kind of said, you know what, it was better than I expected, but you stuck the transponder in the wrong part of the submarine. So I thought two things. First off, you know, I was so pleased that I'd gotten so much of it, at least, you know, generally right.
Yeah.
And the other thing I thought was, you know what? I probably would have stuck the transponder in the wrong part anyway, because it would be really inconvenient for the plot if it was correct. So
and yeah, so it's sometimes we need that willing suspension of disbelief, but I'm sure sticking the transponder in the wrong place is not sort of do or die in terms of the having the story hold together and keeping it believable. 99.9% of the world would not know the difference, I'm sure.
Yeah, pretty much. But you know, I've always been a writer. I've absolutely loved working on these books. The first one came out in February. The next one's coming up this coming February.
Okay.
You know, it's the basic plot is it's about a deep sea diver. Mm-hmm. That's released from prison in order mm-hmm. to track down a missing research scientist. So,
okay,
and very kind of classic adventure, but kind of told in the way that I always wished that these stories were told.
Uh huh. It's sort of a John le Carré kind of a genre, I guess, or international
it's
intrigue.
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything that I've loved. So everything from Clive Cussler to Star Wars to classic sci-fi and Indiana Jones and Doc Savage, and really kind of it's a big hodgepodge. But it was something I hoped I was able to kind of bring into modern storytelling, where there's a level of diversity and complexity and accuracy that has been kind of squeezed out of the genre in recent years.
Is that something that sort of an itch that you wanted to scratch, that you know you just felt like you had to do it, or you know, or was it difficult to do? Some people who write some writers that I know they no matter how good you are at writing, it's always a painful process. I'm just curious how you found it.
I seem to have kind of amnesia after I finish a book. You know, at the time, it was, you know, it's absolutely fantastic. You know, it's really difficult at the time as I'm writing it, but then looking back, I only remember the good points.
Right.
I think it's the only reason why people have more than one child. It's, you know, the same process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the next book is coming out shortly. You said is it a sequel to the first one? Or the earlier one?
Yeah, it's a direct sequel to the first one, but you know, both really do stand up on their own as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it basically picks up where the adventure from the previous one leaves off, and it's in this one they're plunged into a conspiracy dating back to the secret weapons programs of World War II. So this was a really fun opportunity to take all the things I knew and experiences I had with that I-52 project and bring that into a fictionalized environment. So again, I hope that the, you know, my unusual experience and background gives this a layer of depth that I certainly enjoy reading in this genre.
Very cool. Very cool. I'll put the links into this show notes as to where people can find, you know, the Wrecking Crew I think you've posted you've had a few blog posts about the sequel that's coming out as well, so people can check that out, and I'll urge my listeners to check both of those out. I'm also conscious of the time, and I wanted to obviously be very respectful of your time, but I think we've covered a fair bit of ground, but I'm just wondering, just in terms of your own, I guess, kind of career trajectory and the things that you've done, your own sort of philosophy on risk and risk taking, you know, what that is, and you know, if you were to maybe do something differently when you were starting out, if there's anything that you would do differently.
Well, that's a really good question. I think pretty much everybody that does kind of what I do, it has to deal with plenty of self-doubt and in questions and a lot of self-evaluation. I was speaking with someone the other day. He's a journalist and does a lot of adventure travel journalism and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we both kind of laughed and we said that, you know, there's days where we wonder why we just didn't do something ordinary because it's so tough to try to accomplish some of these things that we're trying to accomplish. Mm. And so I think self-evaluation is a really critical part of this. For me personally, I try to kind of boil this down to what do I love about this? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily have to be shipwrecks or expeditions or things like that. It's more about living a life which feels dynamic and fulfilled and where I get to meet interesting people and I get to produce creatively and feel like I can dream about things. Mm-hmm. I think that if you kind of put all of your eggs in one basket, it becomes very painful when something doesn't work, right? Because it's not just a project working, that's part of your identity, which is now being torn away from you.
Right, right.
So for me, I try to balance what I do with other things, traditional jobs, other avenues, other kind of creative outlets, because for me, it's as long as I can kind of hold those essential aspects of, you know, living an interesting life surrounded by interesting people, I'm going to be happy no matter what I do.
Mm-hmm. Now that's beautifully put and very, very sage and profound advice. I think there's one of the things that I, same sort of philosophy I'm taking with this podcast is I haven't quit my day job to sink all the time and energy and resources into this podcast. And you know, not have any it's a bit more of an experiment. And if it goes well, and it so far it has, then you keep doing it. Versus just dropping everything and then all of a sudden that could be quite irreversible and a bit reckless. So I like your point about that sort of balance and taking these different steps. I think that's a useful way of living life, a very helpful way of living a fulfilled life.
Absolutely. And I think it's kind of funny though. I think that this is one of those things where it's I think that there's maybe only one way to learn that lesson, and that's the hard way.
Yeah, sometimes.
Hearing it is one thing, but it's a different process to actually experience and internalize it.
Absolutely. It can be a bit of a bit of a lonely road, and just because you're living a fulfilled life, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy. And in many respects, actually living a fulfilled life isn't meant to be easy. It's if you think about adventure, right, and expeditions and adventure, that implies some level of adversity that you have to deal with.
Yes. Yeah. Very true. Publishing is like that too. Most, unless you're just an incredible talent, very few people get their first novel published.
Right.
Most people, it tends to be more like novel number five.
Right.
And it's such an insanely difficult process. You have to be the sort of person that that any time that you have a really, really bad day, you have to remind yourself, think about all of the other people who are quitting today.
Yeah, right.
And how much smaller my competition is getting right now.
Right. Just on that, how did you publish the Wrecking Crew? What was that process like?
So I'd been through parts of the publishing process before. I had a previous agent that represented me for a bit on a previous project. That ended up kind of falling through, and so I decided that I was going to make the Wrecking Crew I was going to do this as absolute best as I could do with it. Try to learn as much as possible, write the best book I could, and then see what I could do with it. Because it's just as important to learn the business as it is to learn how to write to accomplish something like this. So I finished it. I edited it with the help of some really, you know, really talented people. And then I started looking for a literary agent to represent me. Mm-hmm. And ended up landing what I consider to be the world's best literary agent, Carrie Pistretto out of Prospect Agency, who was able to take me as a debut author and then help develop me into somebody that could get published. Hmm. So it's definitely long, slow process. Yeah. It was all through the front door, so to speak. Okay. No special connections or anything like that.
Yeah. But going through that very, very much also through the front door, I presume in terms of I don't know about traditional model, but did you think about self-publishing at any point?
A bit, but for some people that's perfect. Hmm. For me, the number one thing for me was to have a sense of credibility.
Okay.
And with self-publishing, finding that credibility can be a bit of a steeper slope. Hmm. Again, depending on what you want to do. For me, adventure thriller, having somebody else's publishing stamp on your work gives you kind of a level of immediate cachet, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to try to make kind of converts one at a time.
Right.
And that was just my model. I don't think that there's any inherent, reason why one is better than the other. Mm-hmm. But for me, looking for what I wanted to do long term, it just made much more sense to have be part of the traditional publishing process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. What second half of my question, I guess, if you were to go back to your 19-year-old self, maybe just right after that initial expedition, and give yourself a bit of advice, what might that be?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I spend so much time kind of looking forward at what I want to do next. That's I'm not always the most introspective person. It's probably just to not be so hard on myself all the time. Mm-hmm. On one hand, that's kind of part of my drive, right? Mm-hmm. Is to have a little bit of a relentless perfectionist in my personality. But the flip side is, you know, you can also make yourself really unhappy pretty easily if you just kind of, nothing you do is ever good enough for yourself, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there are parts of the journey where I could have maybe enjoyed it more, as opposed to just being, so continuously tough on myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good advice. I think we all grapple with that from time to time. Taylor, I wanted to wrap it up pretty soon. Conscious of the time, but I think we covered a fair bit of ground. I'm just wondering if there's anything that we may have missed, or anything that you wanted to raise or talk about that we didn't get a chance to.
This has been fantastic. I've really enjoyed everything that we've spoken about. I appreciate so much you mentioning my book as well. It's as a new author, that's always such a
very
big deal.
I'm going to make sure that I include all that in the show notes, and when I get the episode out, I'll also blast away on social media as well. But and just speaking of which, before we do wrap it up, where can people find you, either on the web or on Twitter or things like that, on social media, if they're interested in you and your work?
Oh, absolutely. One of the good things about having such an unusual last name is that I, as far as I can tell, I'm the only one. So I'm pretty easy to Google if you ever want to plug my name into Amazon or Google, anything like that. And beyond that, I blog at expeditionwriter.com, mm-hmm. and I try to keep up with that as not just fun stories that I'm following, but everything that I'm up to as well.
Very good. Again, all that will be in the show notes, and people can check that out. Taylor, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I really enjoyed this conversation. I want to wish you all the best, and once again, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Ben. This was an absolute blast.
Absolutely. Well, let's very much stay in touch, and all the best, and speak soon.
Hey, you too. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye for now. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Check out Taylor's website, expeditionwriter.com. You can check out his book, The Wrecking Crew, which is available on Amazon. And as usual, all the links to everything we talked about are in the show notes. And if you haven't done so yet, check out our new website, allthingsrisk.co.uk. If you have any feedback for me, allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the place to do that. We have another great episode for you next week. Normally we do episodes every other week, but next week, look, I've got some wonderful conversations that I need to get out into the world. And so next week is the next full episode, October the 11th. Stay tuned for that. We are out. We'll speak to you next week. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.